Welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host is Arsene Keshkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Well, today, Arsene, we have a Colorado-based author, but the subject matter is anything but local. And this was a terrific read. Introduce our guest and tell us about the book we've been reading in November.
Our guest is Tiffany Quay Tyson, and the book is The Past Is Never, which is set in Mississippi. Most of the action takes place about 30 years ago, maybe a little longer than that. And it is a wonderful read. It's described as a Southern Gothic. And so I do want to ask you, what is a Southern Gothic, as we welcome you to the show?
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. So, you know, it has been described as Southern Gothic. And Southern Gothic is... basically, it's Gothic fiction set in the South, but it really deals with Southern themes like, I don't know, the desire to continue living in the past, to keep the traditions of the past alive, and sort of a resistance to moving into the future. And there are often haunted places or spooky places in Southern Gothic fiction, including like crumbling mansions. We do not have any crumbling mansions in this book.
Well, you have a quarry, which is at the center of the story. It's a quarry where a family, three kids go swimming, two older siblings and a younger six-year-old. And the six-year-old goes missing. So I guess, what was the inspiration for this story? And maybe talk about setting it at that quarry.
So I, first of all, I just want to say that I just have a pretty good imagination, a pretty vivid imagination. It is a work of fiction. But I did, when I started writing it, I thought, I kind of want to write something about people who experience the same event and yet have very different experiences or very different sort of recall of that event. And so I started out with the siblings thinking, you know, that with siblings, when they experience, siblings never really grow up in the same family, I think. You know, I think that an older sibling and a younger sibling have very different experiences of the world. And so I had these siblings thinking, okay, I have, you know, three siblings going off, two siblings are going to come back, and those two siblings are going to have a vastly different experience about what happened when their younger sister disappeared. They're going to have vastly different reactions to it. And that was sort of the original idea. And I wrote that scene, that original scene that's in the first chapter, of the three siblings going off, going swimming, and one of the siblings not coming back from that trip. And that was kind of where this started. But I was a little bit stuck. I didn't really know what I was going to do with it. I was kind of writing all over the place and not really deciding where it was going, which is how I write. And at some point, I was in Mississippi, and which is where I grew up. I grew up in Mississippi. I was in Mississippi, and I was with my parents. I was with my father and my mom. We were driving around Natchez, Mississippi, which is actually where my dad grew up. And we were looking for haunted things. And so in Natchez, there's a lot of them. There's this thing called the Turning Angel in the cemetery where the angel statue supposedly looks at you no matter where you are. And there's also a thing called a place called the Devil's Punch Bowl, which is a big depression on the banks of the Mississippi River, on the bluffs on the Mississippi River that has all these wild peach trees growing around it, and the peaches just basically fall on the ground and rot, and nobody will eat them because it was essentially a concentration camp for freed slaves post-Civil War. So slaves were basically marched into this big depression and forced to work, and many of them died there. Thousands died there. And so even today, the legend goes, and actually I do think this has been, this is true, even today occasionally bones will float up when the river floods. And so I got to thinking, I love stories like that. I mean, they're terrible stories, but like I love the idea that something, that a place can continue to resonate with something that happened 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, which I think is how places get the... people get the idea that places are haunted, or people get the idea that places are cursed. And I really started thinking about how places come to have that sort of cursed ideology and sort of cursed, how places become cursed. And it's never really the place. It's the people and the things people do there. And so once I started thinking about that, I started thinking about creating my own cursed place. And this quarry where they had gone swimming, the swimming hole, seemed like the right place to. And once I started playing with that idea, I started writing the history of the place, just one little vignette after another, many of which made it into the book, but not all did. And thinking about all of the evil things that might have happened there, that could have happened there, and they all tied back to this one family that is in the book. So that was kind of the genesis of the idea. That's where the story really took off.
What I really like is you're telling the sibling story from Bert's point of view.
Yeah.
She's the sister. She's the second oldest.
Yeah.
But she's maybe 14, and the one who disappears is 6. So there's a big age difference.
Yep.
And so her point of view, first person point of view, is maybe 3/4 of most chapters.
Right.
And then the back part of the chapter is this history of the quarry that starts way back, you know, hundreds of years, 150 years ago maybe, and gradually brings us up to the present day.
Right.
That structure you came upon seems a little different than what I've seen in the past, you know, whether not putting them in the same chapter, not separating them quite the same way. What did that allow you to do? How did that form?
So when I first started writing those historical segments, which do start out as a kind of the history of the quarry, but actually as time goes by, it becomes the history of the family. And it all does sort of start to converge, I think. You know, you start to see the connections. And when I first started writing them, I actually, and I do a lot of this when I'm writing, I really didn't think they were going to make it into the book. I thought I was really just writing the history that I needed to write the forward story. But I kept putting them in because I liked the way it read. When I would have that sort of echo of the present and the past, or at least the present of the book and the past, I liked the way they rubbed up against each other. And so I kept laying them in as I was writing it. And I think I did an entire draft where I took them all out and I read it. And I just, it didn't have the it wasn't as compelling. And so I laid them all back in and then kind of worked to create connections that I thought were meaningful, both throughout the entire book, the thread of the entire book, but also within the chapters. So that I tried to always have a point of connection between Bert's story and the past story. And some of them are pretty subtle and maybe harder to locate, but others I think are pretty obvious. And to me, it just resonated more fully when I had all of that. And that's also when I kind of came up with the title, which of course is a quote from Faulkner. In the South, the past is never dead. It isn't even past. I love that quote, and I think it's true. I think it's probably true outside of the South as well. But I really like the way having that sort of woven structure, I think it adds resonance to the present day story, but I think it also like lends perspective to the stories from the past. That's my hope, at least. I honestly thought that once I turned this into an agent and to an editor, somebody would just say, oh, that's not going to work. Take those out. I really expected that, and they didn't.
I really enjoyed it. It was one of my favorite parts of the book. It really created this friction within the narrative. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think fairly early on, you start figuring out that the two are going to converge. And so you're just waiting for that, and that creates tension.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it made the reading experience more enjoyable, and it made the book much richer.
Thank you.
It was almost like an onion as well, peeling off the layers, because you have the history and the layers that, as you said, Arson, we feel certainly that we're being moved towards the present, and we're going to find out what happened to Pansy, who's that 6-year-old, the youngest sibling in the family. But you're also peeling back the layers of this family, because the fate of the family and the history and the secrets, because like so many families, there are so many secrets within this family. They're also being peeled back as we get to, I suppose, the final chapters of the book as well. When you have a book that's structured like that, I mean, how much is pacing a part of it? Like, how much to reveal? At what point do I reveal this? Because I really felt the pacing was spot on with this.
Thank you. Pacing is hard. I appreciate that, basically, is what I'm saying. I think pacing is really important. One thing that I try to do, and one thing that I think some of my favorite books do well, is not to manipulate the reader by holding stuff back very deliberately and, you know, like dropping a little hint and then saying, but that's all I can tell you. I'm not going to tell you anything else for 100 pages. I try not to do that. I mean, once I introduce something that the narrator knows, I try to go ahead and let the reader know it. So Bird, our narrator, served as a little bit of a foil because she, of course, was discovering this story along with the reader. Whereas the stuff and the information from the past, the stories from the past, are not something she knows as the story. So in some ways, the reader knows more than the narrator through a great portion of the book, which I do think it adds a little suspense because you're not only wondering like what's going to happen and how all these pieces fit together, but you're wondering how Bert's going to discover it. And I think that journey of discovery is just as interesting and as suspenseful as the actual mystery of how this family, you know, how these family's secrets will unfold. And that was my hope, is that journey would also provide some page turning momentum for the reader.
Well, as we always do, we like to have the author read a passage from the book, and particularly because, and we're going to get into this. I mean, this is a book set very much in the South. You yourself are from the South, so I think it's going to be very fitting to have you read this in your own accent and in your own voice.
Great. So this is from chapter 9, and actually this is a section that Arson chose. This is not a section that I've read aloud a lot, but I think it's a good section. I'm excited to read it. So basically here, Bert, the narrator, has gone to work for her grandmother, who is a woman who actually kind of works as a healer and also as a woman's health provider off the books in the South. And she does births, but she also does abortions. She does some herbal medicines, things like that. So, I worked for Granny Clem all through high school. Her house became my second home, and if it weren't for Mama, I'd have spent every minute at Granny Clem's. I was more comfortable there than anywhere else. We marked the passing days and months and years with the only measure that made any sense to us. Most days we didn't speak of it, but on special days, Christmas, the 4th of July, Pansy's birthday, Granny Clem might shake her head and say, "That poor child," and I knew she was referring to Pansy. Or Willett, on the anniversary of Pansy's disappearance, would make a point of being extra careful with Mama, bringing her sweet tea before she had a chance to ask for it, and curbing his tendency to cuss about everything. The first year was the hardest. By the third year, it was routine. I grew up. I would have grown up whether Pansy had disappeared or not, I suppose, but by the time I turned 17, I'd attended dozens of births and learned the difference between poison leaves and edible ones. I don't know who I'd have been if things had turned out different, if we'd found Pansy or never lost her in the first place. Maybe I'd have gone to prom or homecoming games. Maybe I'd have taken up with one of the local boys, a farmer's kid with a permanent tan or the pale, preppy son of an alderman. Maybe I'd have joined the science club or been a reporter for the school newspaper. All sorts of things were possible before Pansy went missing, but her disappearance whittled my world to a sharp point. As it was, I couldn't afford an ordinary adolescence. At Granny Clem's, I dealt with life and death. I spent hours in her garden or her kitchen. I carried the work around with me. My skin smelled of purple and green, lavender and mint, hyacinth and lemon balm, birth and death. Black dirt caked beneath my fingernails. By the time I was a senior in high school, her patients trusted me. I knew so many of them. They were the mothers of my classmates. They were the grocery store clerk and the secretaries on Cotton Row. One of them sat three rows ahead of me in American history class. She'd been particularly shocked to find me when she showed up at Granny Clem's seeking to end an unplanned pregnancy. I learned how to put the women at ease. I figured out how to make my eyes float past them when I saw them on the streets or in the stores. No flicker of recognition, no narrowing my eyes in judgment, no smirk or pity or warmth. The women who came to Granny Clem didn't want my sympathy. They wanted my silence. I gave them what they wanted, and they trusted me. "That one keeps her mouth shut tight," one woman said. Granny Clem nodded. "She's a secret keeper, runs in the family."
That's author Tiffany Quay Tyson reading a passage from her new book, The Past Is Never. Now, we heard that from the perspective of really who's the main narrator in the story, Bert, Roberta. And there's so much going on in that passage. And I definitely want to dig into that other character, Granny Clem or Clementine. She's so interesting. But what really jumped out at me in the book, but particularly that passage, is the impact of tragedy on a family and how that reverberates long past the either trauma that's been inflicted. In this case, it's the disappearance of a child. And there's so many other examples. It could be the death of somebody or an accident, and how that creates a moment in time that you're frozen in mm-hmm. as a family and as an individual. And there's a character in the book who comes along, this woman who comes to visit the family, who has also had a child who's disappeared, who tries to convey that to the mother. Bert is quite, suspicious of her. The mother seems to welcome her in, just about how this is going to impact you and what this is going to mean for your family. Talk us through why you wanted to have somebody like that to come in and kind of almost explain that, and maybe what research you did about trauma and its impact on families.
So the woman who comes after Pansy disappears is a woman whose son had also disappeared, and she also has not found her son. And she comes in and basically says to the family, you know, this is how this is going to go. And these are the people you're going to hear from, and this is how it's going to feel. And I actually, I put her in after reading a lot of newspaper articles about the parents of missing children. And almost all of these articles that I read would actually talk about psychics, like the people who were who had lost their family member would talk about the psychics that called them, or the people who would call with sightings, especially if there was some sort of reward offered. And I just thought that was fascinating. It was not something I think I had thought a ton about until I started exploring this. And one thing that I will say is that when I started writing a story about a child who had gone missing, the one thing that I was very committed to doing was not writing a story that turned out the way so many missing child stories turn out. I didn't want to end up in a basement or with sexual abuse, or, you know, there were a lot of things that I wanted to avoid. And so I wanted to write something a little more unexpected. And yet I wanted it to ring true. And so I did read a lot of newspaper articles and a lot of interviews with people who had people go missing. And that was just sort of a common thread. Was that these people would call and they would get this kind of contact. And every time somebody reported spotting a child that looked like their child, it would create this wave of hope that was often pretty cruel, frankly. And I wanted some way to convey that to the mother. And so I did actually create this other mother who could come in and be kind of a mirror for the family and tell them what it was like. And I like the idea just generally of before and after. I think, you know, with any novel, there's always some sort of big incident, and the way life was before that incident and the way life is after that incident, even if it's a quieter trauma, is very different. You know, once you experience whatever that precipitating incident is, in this case, it's a child going missing, your life before that looked one way. Your life after that will always look a different way, no matter what happens. And I think that that's an interesting thing to explore. And it's a very stark dividing line for characters to kind of explore how they might go off in a different direction than the one they had expected, which is what I think Bert is talking about right there. You know, she's looking back on it with a little bit of reflection and thinking, well, I would have grown up regardless, but I might have grown up very different.
The other thing that happens at the same time mm-hmm. is the father disappears.
Yeah.
And he's somebody who would sometimes go off for 2 weeks and nobody would know where he is and come back. And so when she disappears, he's been missing mm-hmm. for a couple weeks. Nobody thinks anything of it, but he never shows back up. And this actually, in a strange way, provides some hope. Like perhaps Pansy is with him, right, is what you think the whole time. And I thought that was interesting in a missing person story, that often I think you read these types of things, and if the family has hope, you think it's a false hope. There's no chance. Here, though, you're reading thinking, when's the father going to come back? And so I thought that was a very interesting dynamic that you set up, that there actually was a possibility that something happened with Pansy.
Yeah, I really wanted, like I said, I really did want to kind of subvert the idea of a missing child story and offer some different opportunities for the possibility of what had happened. And I don't want to have any spoilers here, so I won't go any further into it. But with the dad, you know, I did think that by making him the sort of guy who disappears and is pretty unreliable to begin with, it does create, I think, a level of, it creates some questions and created questions in my mind as I was writing it, but also questions in the reader's mind about how much he may or may not have to do with the disappearance. But the truth is, when children disappear, it is pretty often with a parent or with a parent or parental figure or with a relative. And so actually that little bit of optimism that they have is really based in reality, because the truth is most kids who are kidnapped or who disappear or who, you know, are taken from their homes are actually taken by a relative. And so I like the idea of having something that's so possible be right at the forefront for the whole mm-hmm. book. More or less.
One of the things that really struck me about this book was at the heart of it are two brother-sister combinations. I'm an older brother with two younger sisters, so this would feed into, like, if some disaster struck, I'd be with my sisters or something. And you have Willett and Bert, but you also have, in the backstory, you come to learn that the father mm-hmm. and his sister, Fern, have quite a relationship. And I think that those are kind of the two axes or something that the story revolves around, those two brother-sister relationships, which, again, is something I feel like I don't see that much in fiction so much. Often you get two brothers or two sisters or parents, but it was interesting how they paralleled each other.
I love books that have that sort of mirroring technique. I love the idea of parallel storylines. And so I don't even know that I did that consciously. I mean, at some point I was, of course, quite aware that I had a brother and a sister, both in both timelines, both sort of searching for different things, both kind of abandoned by their parents in different ways. And, you know, obviously those echoes and similarities became apparent to me as I was writing the book, but I didn't necessarily set out to write these two stories, these two sort of parallel stories. That's something that happened in the process of writing. When I went back and was rewriting, which is really writing, I mean, really the better part of writing, it was then that I kind of amplified some of those similarities, because it was interesting to me that we had these multiple generations that had so much mirroring. And it also, again, like with the title, The Past Is Never Dead, It Isn't Even Past, it just shows how families and generations will continue to repeat the patterns of the past generations, almost no matter what you do. You know, you really do, I think, continue to... What happened to your parents does have an effect on you.
Well, one of the other characters that you touched on in the passage that you read is Granny Clem. She appears in the previous timeline as Clementine. Mm-hmm. And so we hear her backstory as well. And as you said, she's a woman who plays a really important role in the community. She's not just an abortion provider, but she's really a woman's health advocate. Yes. And I thought you fleshed out her character really nicely, because I do think there's a tendency to portray characters like that in very one-dimensional. And in if she had lived 200 years prior, she would have been labelled a witch.
Right.
But right now she's providing an incredible service in this community. And I'm just wondering, from your own experience growing up, were there women that people knew existed in the community? Nobody necessarily talked about them. And you talked about kind of the invisibility of Bert then coming in as an apprentice. You don't make eye contact. You don't acknowledge the women that you're helping in the community when you meet them in other circumstances.
Yeah, I don't know that growing up I knew women like that necessarily. But I will say that one thing that I do remember growing up is, you know, and I mentioned this in the book, abortion only became legal right around the time that this book starts, a few years earlier. And Mississippi has never been a place where getting an abortion is an easy thing to do. I do know women who had abortions in Mississippi over the years, mostly when I was a little bit younger, like college age. And I do know that it's something we never talked about. If you even knew about it, you didn't talk about it. I also knew women who were sent off, you know, again, college type age, to have babies and then came back the next semester. And again, you could not discuss it. There was just no, and it didn't matter if you were close friends. It didn't, you know, none of that mattered. We really didn't discuss it. And I think that that's where a lot of that comes from. But yeah, Granny Clem is one of my, I really, if I'm going to write a character, I have to like them enough to spend a lot of time with them. And Granny Clem is in a huge portion of this book. And ultimately, I sort of loved her. I thought she was great and really strong and strong-willed and had a really good sense of what she could do, what she wanted to do, what she was willing to do. I thought she was a great influence on Bert, even though I think some people would argue otherwise, perhaps. But I think she was wonderful. And I enjoyed writing her. And I really do like the idea. I like this idea of women helping other women, which is what Granny Clem lives to do. You know, she basically, she took care of her mother as her mother was ill when she was much younger. And then after that, she continued to take care of woman after woman after woman. And she gave the women what they needed, not what Granny Clem thought they needed, but what they thought they needed. And I think there's too little of that in the world, frankly.
I felt she saved Bert. She rescued her from a house that was just mired in the mother's suffering around the disappearance of Pansy. It really reminded me of a lot of stories coming out of Ireland as well, about, because of course the abortion restrictions there until the last couple of years. But there were also homes that young women, and I knew people who would go to a home, have the baby, and then would come away without the baby, and few questions were asked. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, there are a lot of discoveries about illegal adoptions and various different social engineering programs where babies were taken. The Catholic Church was, of course, really involved in that, not just in Ireland, but really around the world. Granny Clem had a much more altruistic approach to all of this and a much more kind-hearted approach. But was at the same time placing babies in homes, but knowing this family needs this baby as much as this baby needs this family.
Right. I don't think she did anything out of greed or out of a sense of maliciousness or out of a sense of her own idea of what should happen. She really did have good altruistic intentions, and she followed her own conscience and didn't really allow sort of the mores of the day to dictate what she should do or someone else to dictate what she should do. So yeah, I agree with that. And I think that I think all over the world and really in every community, there are probably people who either have had, like you said, had abortions, had legal abortions that were very hard to come by, or who ended up having babies and giving up those babies either sight unseen or very quickly. And then they're expected to never talk about it again or never think about it again. And I think that's a lot to expect of any woman. I don't think Granny Clem believed that was possible. And I think she did what she could to make these women's lives easier. She couldn't fix it. She could make it easier.
No, this book, of course, is set in a couple of timelines, the most recent one being in the 1970s.
Yeah.
You mentioned that around that time, abortion was legalized. Now we're seeing a rollback, of course,
of
reproductive rights, in particular in southern states. So I would imagine that these women have never gone away.
No, I know that there are still women in the South, and not just women. There are men in the South. There's still illegal or unsanctioned abortion providers. Probably everywhere, but certainly in the South. And it's dangerous and kind of horrifying.
Well, Tiffany Quay Tyson has been our guest at the Radio Book Club today. Her latest book is The Past Is Never, and it's described as a Southern Gothic. It's unputdownable. If we had an index for unputdownability, this would get a 2-day rating from me, because I read it in 2 days, and knowing how busy I am, that's pretty high up. There's a lot in this book. In fact, it's won several awards, and it was a finalist in the Colorado Book Award for Literary Fiction. We do encourage our listeners to, of course, subscribe to this podcast, because you're going to get the bonus edition after hours at the Radio Book Club. Tiffany Quay Tyson will stick with us. But as we always do in the radio version of the interview, we announce what we're going to be reading for the next month. And we've got a great book that we're inviting listeners to read along with us, Arson, for December.
We'll be reading Sabrina and Karina, which is a collection of short stories, which Maeve and I always love to do. And it's a Denver author. Collie Fiardo Anstein is the author of this book. And it's really an interesting book about explores friendships, mothers, daughters, and also talks about indigenous ancestries, Chicano, Latino communities tied into this. And the book is a finalist, as we're speaking right now, is a finalist for the National Book Award. That award will be given right after the interview with her. So we'll know whether she wins or not. But it's a big deal for it to be a finalist.
But we do encourage folks to read along with us. And of course, you can find out more information about all the books and hear past episodes at news.kgnu.org. But please do subscribe to the podcast of the Radio Book Club. It's a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Arsene Kashkashian is always my co-host with the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Maeve.
And thanks so much to Tiffany Quay Tyson for coming in and joining us at the book club today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran.